May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I want to talk about paradox, because I don't think you get at what these texts are saying without having some notion of paradox and the role that paradox plays in spiritual teaching. Paradox, of course, is where you have two things that are rationally incompatible with each other, and you're holding that both are true. And they can't both be true, and yet you're holding that both are true. And it's fundamentally an irrational thing to do, and yet sometimes you say, well, that's the most rational thing I know. Because sometimes there are things beyond human understanding, or sometimes beyond our limited understanding. And so reason, rationality, can only capture so much, and there is something beyond which is. And so often humans or spiritual traditions use paradox as a way of getting at that which we can't, which we see dimly, which we see imperfectly, but as a way of trying to get at something that is more fundamental and solid. And I think that's what both Paul and Jesus are doing in today's texts. And I think it's what's at the heart of this whole notion of death and life and resurrection, and the paradox that is there. Paul starts this out. I know there were several people at the 8 a.m. who are cringing at this Romans passage, because they don't like this opposition of flesh and spirit. They're chafing at that opposition of flesh and spirit, and justly so, because the church has misused Paul for centuries now, and has done that in some ways by saying flesh is bad and spirit is good, and therefore you shouldn't drink and dance and smoke. And instead you should go to church for 3 hours on Sunday. But that's not what this is about, basically. Paul is trying to grapple with how it is in our very humanness, our very creatureliness, sometimes we can be in opposition to God, in opposition to the divine, in opposition to what actually may be in our own best benefit spiritually. And so he's noting that there is this tendency for us in our own creatureliness to kind of be myopic and one-sided, and he's trying to open us up to the presence of the Spirit, the presence of the power of the Spirit of God. And so he sets up this opposition between flesh and spirit unfortunately, the church has not done justice to in the course of its centuries. But he comes up with this statement, but if Christ is in you, and he talks about the Spirit of God dwelling in you. Later he'll talk about we are jars of clay. These bodies we have are jars of clay that hold the Spirit, right, at some level. And he's trying to get at the nature. These are two qualitatively different kinds of things in his thinking. But he's saying that you are flesh, and yet the Spirit of God dwells in you. How can that be that you are? He says, if Christ is in you, then he's meaning the Spirit of Christ. If Christ is in you, though the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is life because of righteousness. So you get that sense of paradox. You're dead in sin and yet alive in the Spirit. And how can you be both at the same time? Martin Luther played upon this. He liked Paul. And so Martin Luther talked about us being simultaneously sinners and saints. You can be both at the same time, sinner and saint, in paradox. Meaning that sometimes you fail to love profoundly. And sometimes you love well. And sometimes you do that with the very same person that you're in relationship with. And how is it? Right? How can you be simultaneously a sinner and a saint, right? And be loved by God in the midst of it, right? So that's one paradox that Paul is using. Jesus uses another paradox in this story where he says, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Be honest. Do you believe this? This is the problem of paradox, because Jesus senses that he says, no, if you if you believe in me, even if you die, you will live. That's the paradox right there. Even if you die, you will live. And if you live and believe in me, you'll never die. Even though you're going to die, you will never die. Do you believe this? Right? Paradox. He's trying to get at something. And I think both in Paul and Jesus are trying to get at this notion of life and death, and they're struggling with the notion of life and death because that was a part of their Jewish tradition. Paul was trained as a Pharisee, and Jesus was steeped in the scriptures. And it's part of the Jewish tradition to have this sense that God gives us life even in the midst of our death. And that's what the Ezekiel passage is all about. In Judaism, it's a strong passage, right? The context for that Ezekiel passage is that the people of Israel had been taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. The Babylonians had come on. They'd been, this is around in the 590s, 580s BCE. King Nebuchadnezzar is, you know, the ruler of Babylon. He's been at war. He's taken the king and the royal family and the leadership and the artisan class, and he's taken them all in captivity and relocated them from Jerusalem and Israel to Babylon. Right? I mean, I'm not even sure what the distance is, but it's quite a journey to get over there. And then they're plopped into this culture to be used by the Babylonians to improve their economy, right? To improve their well-being, right? And so now these people are dislocated, and there was a group of them that happened to in the 90s, and then there was a puppet king that was established in Israel, and then he didn't do what he was supposed to, and then in 587, Nebuchadnezzar comes in and besieges Jerusalem and sacks it and destroys the temple and takes all of the gold and everything in the temple and divides it up, and then again, basically destroys. And so this people, you know, who had some hope of returning, who had some hope of being in captivity, now their despair has deepened. And they find themselves in a foreign land in a people with strange food and strange customs, and they are filled with grief. They're filled with despair. And they say, our bones are dried up. We are dead. We have no hope. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but I know what they're talking about. My bones are dried up. It's that sense of just the empty ache. Like, have you ever had that empty ache? It feels like you're just dead inside. And it's intolerable. That's what they're talking about, is this empty feeling. Our bones are dried up. And so God says to Ezekiel, who's a prophet in Babylon, this is happening in Babylon, it's not happening in Israel, it's in Babylon, where God says to Ezekiel, God basically gives him a vision. God takes Ezekiel and puts him into this valley filled with dried bones, because that's what the people have been saying, our bones are dried up. And God's like, okay, I hear you, your bones are dried up. And so he gives Ezekiel this vision of a valley filled with dry bones. And these are dry bones, right? This isn't like newly, you know, fresh bones with marrow in them and they're still white. These have been baked in the sun over the courses of years. They're dry. They're dead. They're shattered. And God says to Ezekiel, mortal, can these bones live? And the rational response is no. There is no life left in these bones. There's no way these bones can live. These bones are so broken and desiccated and destroyed that structurally it just wouldn't work to put them back together. No, there is no way that these bones can live. And that may be what Ezekiel thought, but it's not what he said. God says, mortal, can these bones live? And Ezekiel says, oh God, you know. You alone know. Which was a really safe answer for Ezekiel to say. And so God says, prophesy. Prophesy to these bones. Speak to these bones that are dead. Tell them that I will put breath into them and flesh and sinew. Prophesy to these bones. So Ezekiel prophesies. He speaks. He gives voice. He uses his breath to give voice. And he prophesies. And there's this sound and there's this rattling and the bones come together and then there's sinews and tendons and flesh and muscle and skin that goes upon these bones. And then apparently I think you've got bodies that are laying there in this valley, looking healthy, but there is no breath. That's a curious pause in the story. I mean, it's partially done, but it's not fully done. That this is flesh. What you see is flesh. It's a valley full of flesh that is lying there. Flesh without spirit. And so God says to Ezekiel, prophesy, prophesy to the wind, prophesy to the breath, that the spirit may come upon these bones. And we don't speak Hebrew, but if we spoke Hebrew, the word there for breath and spirit and flesh is ruach. It's the same word. Breath, spirit, and flesh all mean ruach in Hebrew. And so God is playing upon this idea. And he's calling to mind this notion that when God creates Adam, God spits in the mud and fashions the human. And there the human is lying on the ground without the breath of God. And then God breathes God's breath into Adam. And Adam's lungs take it in, and there is breath, and there is spirit, and there is life. God is reminding God's people that I am the one who gives life. I am the one who puts my spirit in you. And so Ezekiel prophesies to the wind, he prophesies to the breath, he prophesies to the spirit, and the wind blows and the spirit moves and the breath of life comes into these folks and they come alive and they stand up and there is a valley of humans with their eyes glittering in and you know moving in the valley. And God says, mortal, this is the whole people of Israel. These are my people. And I will bring them back to their land. I give them life and I will bring them back to their land. So that's a central story for the nation of Israel. It's a central story about the character of God and who God is and what God does. That God gives life. It's God that is the giver of life. It is the Spirit of God that animates our flesh. I think that's what Paul is trying to get at in his Romans reading. When he's talking about flesh and spirit, and you know, you can be dead in your flesh, and yet you need to be alive in the spirit. Paul's concern is not so much about flesh as it is about being alive in the spirit. And having the Spirit of God in you, understanding the necessity for being in tune and open to the Spirit of God flowing through you. Jesus was also influenced by that story. He knew that story in his bones. And so this story, John, you know, places this chapter 11 is in the very middle of the book of John. There are 10 chapters before this chapter. There are 10 chapters after this chapter. This is a central, in a very literal sense, this is a central story to the book of John. And you just heard it read. We talked last week about the last time Jesus was in Jerusalem, and in this area, he was in the temple, and he was in the temple, and people were picking up stones and were going to throw stones at him, and he walks out of the temple as they are about to stone him. That is what has just happened for Jesus in Jerusalem. People were literally so angry at him that they were going to stone him, and Jesus and his disciples hightail it out of Jerusalem, and they go off across the Jordan. And that's where they're hanging out and living when they get word from Mary and Martha that Lazarus is ill. And it's an urgent message. They're saying, Jesus, come, because Lazarus, your friend, our brother, is ill. We need you here to save him. And the story says that though he loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, he tarried for 2 days. Good King James Version. He tarried. He waited. He paused. And you're like, Jesus, what are you doing? Why don't you answer? It's like the psalmist, out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord, hear my voice. Why don't you answer? He doesn't come. He tarries. He waits. And then after two days, he says to his disciples, I think we should go and help our brother Lazarus. And they're like, what? We just left there. They were just trying to kill you. Are you going back there? Why are you going back there? And Jesus is like, well, when the light shines during the day, you don't stumble, and at night you stumble, but it's light, and the light is shining. We should go, because Lazarus is sleeping. And his disciples are like, Lord, if Lazarus is sleeping, he'll wake up. You don't need to go to Jerusalem. They don't get it, which is what I love about the disciples. They don't get it. Over and over and over again, they don't get it. And Jesus doesn't make it hard. It's like, well, you said he was sleeping. You didn't say he was dead. You said he was sleeping. And so Jesus has to clarify. Well, really what I meant is that he's dead. And we're going to go towards death. We're going to take our journey and we're going to move towards death, into death. Because he knows that this is the beginning of his journey towards his own death. That's what's happening here. And the disciples know it. And they're trying to keep him back from that journey into death. And they say, don't go. And he's like, no, we're going. And so Thomas, who everybody thinks is a doubting Thomas, he's the one that says, let us go that we may die with him. Jesus and the disciples then make their journey towards death. That's part of the paradox here. It's not a moving away, it's a movement or into. And they get to Bethany, and they hear the sounds of wailing and the sounds of mourning. And Martha gets word that he's coming, and she gets up and she runs, and she meets him outside of their house or their compound, and she's mad at him. She says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Why didn't you show up? Why weren't you here? And he says, Lazarus will live again. And she's like, I know he'll be in the resurrection on the last day. She thinks he's talking about resurrection after we're dead, which is often, but that's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about that resurrection that happens after you're dead. He's talking about resurrection that happens while you're alive. That's what he's interested in talking about. And he says to her, I am the resurrection. I am the life. He who believes in me, even if they die, will live. And he who lives and believes in me will never die. Even if they die, do you believe this? Right? And she doesn't quite say yes. What she says is, I know you're the Messiah. Which is an affirmation of sorts, but it's not a, oh yeah, I understand the paradox. She goes back inside, and then Mary hears that he's there, and Mary comes, and she is filled with grief, and I mean, her pain is apparent, and she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And she, too, has anger, but her anger is related to the loss, and why wasn't he there? And when Jesus hears her grief, and he sees the grief around him, our translation says he was greatly troubled. And the Greek verb there it really is about the gut. Kim was right. It really is about feeling it in your gut. This is gut-wrenching sorrow. This is gut-wrenching, grief that's happening for Jesus. And it says that Jesus wept, right? And it's not like there's this little tear that comes out of Jesus' eye. This is an ugly cry, right? This is Jesus being racked with grief over what's happened and what's happening. And he goes to the tomb in his own grief. He stumbles over to the tomb, and again he feels it, and he says, "Roll away the stone." And Martha's like, "No, don't roll away the stone, because the stench of death will come out." We avoid death. We're afraid of death. We're disgusted by the stench of death. Everything in our animal bodies tells us to avoid and stay away from death. And it's that fear. And the invitation here is to not run away. It's to step towards, to enter in. And so Jesus says, roll away the stone. Open up the tomb. Let light and fresh air in. And he says to Lazarus, "Lazarus, come out." And wherever Lazarus is, whatever it is that Lazarus is experiencing, Lazarus responds. Lazarus hears Jesus' voice, and he responds, and he comes out, bound in grave clothes, whatever grave clothes look like. It's not mummy grave clothes. That's Egyptian. This is something else. But Jesus says, "Unbind him and let him go." That story is connected to this Ezekiel story. And then in this Ezekiel story, you know, God says, "I will bring you up from your graves. I will open your graves and I will bring you up from your graves." Right? This is a living out of that. And Ezekiel's not meaning these are live people that he's talking to. These are living people that Ezekiel is prophesying to. And he's saying, "I will bring you, open up your graves and bring you out of your graves because you feel like you're dead. I will give you life." And Jesus is doing the same thing here. This is not a magic act. This is not about some superhuman superpower coming in and this is about the power and presence of God entering into our grief and suffering and bringing about life. Taking grief and suffering and reworking it and making it into life. That's what this is about. I mean, the Christian, and this is at the heart of what Christianity is fundamentally as a faith. It's this conviction that even though we die, even though we suffer, there is something deeper than death and suffering. Because the reality is, it's not a denial of death. We embrace our mortality, right? Those of you who were here on Ash Wednesday, we started this Lenten journey, and we stood here in this sanctuary, and I took ashes, black ashes, and I put them on your forehead, and I said, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And that's hard for me to do with some of you, because I know you're close. I wept with some of you, because I know that you're close. We're on a road towards death, all of us. And the conviction is that despite that, there's something deeper and more profound that holds our very being and our essence that gives us life. Amen.